Subway has teamed up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for $5 to participating Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See store for details. Subway. Eat fresh.
Eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to BS Report. Very rarely do the guests come over to the mansion to do a podcast, but in this case, the master of the roast, one of the great comedians of modern times, Mr. Jeff Ross. Welcome to the BS Report.
Thank you, pal.
You're not on the Subway Fresh Take hotline because you're here.
I'm right here.
You don't need to be in a hotline.
Thomas Jefferson was bar mitzvahed in this house.
it's an older house.
It's beautiful. Very beautiful.
Thank you.
You're a lucky man and a talented guy.
Oh,
thank you for having me on your podcast.
Thank you. No, you're supposed to be you're supposed to butter me up at the end of the podcast, not in the beginning.
That's how I do it. Jeff Ross thing.
Yeah, you do the 6 minutes of meanness, followed by, but Joan.
Where would I be without you? You're the one who called me the Michael Jordan of roasting.
It's a fair phrase. Let's talk about that first, because you just did the Joan Rivers roast.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's probably the best possible subject for you, Joan Rivers. That could go in the most directions. Plastic surgery, old, the daughter. There's a lot to work with.
The jewelry.
Yeah.
It was tricky, though. I never roasted a dead person before. She took it well. I never really felt like this before with a roast that... She's been making fun of people for 40 years or
right.
So I felt like a certain, like people, I was roasting her vicariously for everybody she's ever slammed.
Right. And she had said some mean things over the years, so.
And she continues to.
Yeah, so the what's that saying? The roosters came home to roost?
The roasters came home to roast?
Yeah.
You know what, and to her credit, like, a lot of comedians, they get older and they sort of do like an act that belongs on the History Channel.
Right.
She stays relevant. Like, she went up at the end and schooled everybody killed. It was a great roast.
Yeah.
But she schooled everybody at the end. I mean, she really did an amazing.
She went one by one and
rebuttal.
Just killed everybody?
It was like a machine gun. She just went after every single person, new material, completely relevant, current. Like Michael Jackson, Octomom, like she had it all in there. And then she finishes it all. I don't want to give too much away, but an American flag drops behind her, like four stories high, and she goes into a incredible performance piece about patriotism and how the country needs Joan Rivers more than ever. And
really?
It ends with confetti. People are going to be blown away by her performance. She should get an Emmy nomination for this.
I thought roast might be on the way out, but it seems like they've now made there's been a resurgence. I thought the Chevy Chase roast, I thought that was it. I mean, you didn't go to that one, but that was sad. It was like just these people I'd never heard of, and Chevy just had this look on his face, like, what's happened to my career? And it seemed like that was it.
Well, you make a good point. Like, there's roasts that are poorly produced, and there's roasts that are produced well. Joel Gowan and Comedy Central, they do a great job of elevating this to...
You're plugging people this early?
No, but it means a lot to me, because there was a Cheech and Chong roast on another network that was awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned the Chevy Chase roast.
Oh, don't forget the Shaq All-Star Celebrity roasts.
Well, that was fun.
Well, they were fun. Does that go in the poorly produced or the well-produced?
That goes into, that's tricky.
Yeah, how about uniquely produced?
That's good, because I did have some certain parameters when they called me for that. I said I didn't want to be the only white guy in the days.
Well, that was the night that I fell in love with you.
Oh.
As a man crush. Oh. Because, yes, you were the only white guy there. You came right up. You killed it right away. You did the, what'd you say? Like, this isn't a roast, it's a barbecue.
It was great.
Shaq loved it. I mean, he could not have been a greater sport. He was fantastic.
He was very cool about it. After the show, he took me out to play craps, and I don't really know how to play craps. I'm more of a poker or a blackjack guy when I'm in a casino. So Shaq, you know, and you know the way he throws dice, like he's just basically reaching over the table and dropping them on the other side. His arms are so long. And I didn't know about craps, so I just said, this guy's a winner in life.
Yeah.
I just told the pit boss, the dealer, just, I want to follow Shaq. And I made, this is a benefit we did for Shaq's children charity, the roast. So afterwards, I went out and made $1,000 just following Shaq on the craps table.
Wow. By the way, that's not a great strategy all the time, because like if you had followed Michael Jordan or Charles Barkley, I think you would have lost. There are two great things that happened in that roast. It was, your thing was great. And then I think that was the same one as the Doug Williams, Jamie Foxx evisceration.
Yeah.
Which Doug Williams is just coming back from like 6 years later.
That was a very, very remarkable performance. There was one other thing that got cut out of that show.
Yeah.
That a lot of people don't know about was, you know who Moose Johnson is, right?
They showed a little of him, but I know the story, but tell it.
Moose Johnson, Jamie did a similar thing. People can YouTube this. About Doug Williams and Jamie goes on as his conscience. And
well, Doug Williams went up and he was a little nervous and he started taking shots at people. And for some reason, Jamie just went after him.
Right.
And just killed him.
Jamie, as a good roastmaster should, felt a certain responsibility to keep the show moving.
And to end this guy's career.
I guess so. You know, I mean, it really separates the men from the boys. You know, one of the appeals of roasting is that it is sort of competitive. It's like a comedy all-star game, if you will. I mean, you have a bunch of really great players all concentrating on the same subject.
Yep.
So it gets competitive because you have to look for different angles.
Well, you should explain. You get a list of, like, here's all the people. Here's who'll be in the dais. Who's here? Who's in the audience?
Right.
And so you make a Microsoft Word doc sheet with the subject headings. You got Shaq, and you just start writing Shaq jokes and so on down the line. But
well, the best ones are where you can get a couple people in one.
Right. I call a multiple drive-by shooting.
I call those twofers.
Nice. Nice.
You know, it was like one of those sort of like moments in time where you start to work your partnerships. Like Jamie Foxx and I were good friends. We'd helped each other with certain other projects and other roasts. So I do a joke. And a joke that could possibly get an ooh from the audience got an applause break because Jamie's on the side of the dais kicking the punchlines, like giving me all this extra, like, I don't know what, it's not a cheerleader, it's something else. It's like a hype man or something.
He's like Black McMahon.
Ed Black Man. he was great, you know, and...
Well, tell the Moose Johnson part, though.
So Moose Johnson goes up. I can't remember. I think this was kind of early in the show. It might have even been before the Doug Williams thing happened, so it was even ballsier, you know?
Yeah.
Moose Johnson goes up, and he's dressed like he's, you know, the congressman from the great state of whatever.
I mean, this was the Emmett Smith roast. Yeah. We should mention that. Shaq wasn't the subject. It was Emmett Smith.
Shaq was the producer.
Yes.
The host, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, the co-host with Jamie Foxx.
Right.
And... we're roasting Emmett Smith. This was before Dancing with the Stars. This is Emmett Smith doing his commercials with Alf. That was like Emmett Smith's big like area to goof on. There wasn't a lot there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Moose Johnson goes on with a huge notebook. I mean, you just see that he has 20 pages of crap. And that... by page three, you realize this is like his audition for a sports casting job. This is not a roast of Emmett Smith.
It's the concept of the roast has been improperly explained to him. He thought it was like
well
a tribute.
Put.
Yes.
He really did not know what he was getting into.
Yeah.
Even though there was Monique and Jamie Foxx and me and the Torrey brothers and all these funny comedians, Moose Johnson goes up and he's taking it very, very seriously.
Yeah.
He's doing an impassioned speech about sportsmanlike conduct, about Emmett Smith and his amazing career and accomplishments. And we're getting bored.
It was like
by page nine.
It was a eulogy.
It was a eulogy for, right. So by page like nine of his 40 page discourse, Jamie Foxx starts, you know, whispering into his little lapel mic funny Moose Johnson jokes. Just basically interrupting him, you know, like effing with him. Not anything real dirty or mean, but just interrupting him. And let's face it, these guys are not used to getting interrupted.
They're used to punching people in the face that do so.
Or they're used to having 50 mics in front of them and saying nothing,
yep.
You know, after a game.
Right.
Whatever. So here's Moose Johnson, a blossoming player turned sportscaster, whatever, not used to getting goofed on, not taking it well.
No.
And he gets to his speech. He doesn't end early, the way Doug Williams did later, smartly. He keeps going through all 40 pages of this bound notebook that's laid out like something a candidate would have, you know, in big
right.
type. And it's just like he walks off and Jamie Foxx goes back to the podium. And just as he's about to say, give a hand for Moose Johnson, a stool comes flying at Jamie Foxx.
From Moose Johnson?
Yeah. Moose Johnson takes the stool and just starts, like, he just hurls it at Jamie Foxx, missing him by inches.
Wow.
I think a lesson was learned. You got to leave the roasting to the professionals.
I think it's funny that he's now a football announcer, a lead color guy for, I think he's like the number three guy for Fox, maybe.
Really?
And has no sense of humor. You'd think sense of humor would be like a little bit part of it. Because you came up later, and I think you've made a joke like,
yeah.
You said something like, I'd go longer, but Moose Johnson did all my s***. And they cut to him, and he looked like homicidal.
Well, he was, by now he's mad at me too, because, you know, we're all in on it. We're right. all laughing, you know, and he's just not getting it. And, you know, luckily he didn't kill Jamie Foxx.
You were at the famous post 9/11 roast too.
I produced that
Hugh Hefner.
I produced that one.
That's probably the all-time memorable roast, I would have to say.
Interesting.
I think that I'm going to put that number one because what was it, like 2.5 weeks after 9/11?
Yeah, it was about that.
Little tense. Nobody knows how far they can go.
Well, the interesting thing was that we had to decide the week of 9/11. 9/11 was a Tuesday.
Yeah.
On Friday, essentially. No, maybe it was on the Monday.
Yeah.
We had to decide whether to go ahead with the truck rentals and the venue and, you know, the deposits that had
to
be
it was in New York, right?
Protected. It was in New York. So I had this other responsibility of convincing the comedians, the producers, Comedy Central, the Friars Club, and Hef and his posse. They get on a private plane and fly to New York and put tuxedos on
yeah.
and crack jokes when, quite frankly, 2 miles away, it's still smoldering.
Yeah.
At ground zero. So.
And nobody was in a good mood on the Friday after 9/11. Nobody was in a congenial mood. I remember going out on that Saturday and just one of the most somber going out experiences I've ever had. Just people at a bar, like all kind of just sad and not knowing what to do, getting drunk.
In New York, you still had to run around with your t-shirt over your nose. You know, you couldn't really go out.
Were you living there then?
Yeah.
Where were you living?
Greenwich Village, about a mile north of the towers. And
there's no way you were awake.
Ralphie May screaming into my answering machine, Ross, wake up. Where are you? What are you doing? You know, and I think I'm dreaming it. I hear sirens whizzing by my window.
Yeah.
And
for those who don't know, Jeff Ross likes to sleep late.
Well, you know, you're a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, this is
you're in the lifestyle.
You know, and I was supposed to fly to L.A. that day. Ralphie knew that. I had just headwritten. I was the head writer for the MTV Video Music Awards 2 nights before.
Right.
Jamie Foxx hosted. And they all knew that I was flying out that day.
Yeah.
On the same airline a few hours later.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Crazy, man. Crazy.
And so, what kept you alive probably was that you would never have gotten up that early for a flight, right?
You're probably right.
You wouldn't get up at 8 o'clock to. It'd be like get up at 6 o'clock. And that's freaky. I never knew that
story. Well, what else kept me alive was the fact that I was in New York and not flying out of Boston.
Oh. That's true. I didn't even think of that. Well, why would you have been in Boston then?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh. It's true. You lived in New York.
Yeah, well, it was, I mean, who knows? You know, it was very strange. And Ralphie woke me up. I turned on the news. And instantly I went into, like, crisis mode.
Yeah.
I kind of had a hunch that people would be evacuating lower Manhattan. So I ran to the deli and the cash machine. And I got food and cash. And lo and behold, I showed up back at my house 20 minutes later. And there was Dave Chappelle, his wife, and new baby with ashes all over them.
Jesus.
Evacuating the Soho Grand downtown, the hotel. So within hours, I had couple other comedians and friends, and I had a shelter, essentially. It was a very strange time. And by the end of the week, I'd written a letter to Hef and the Friars and everybody, Comedy Central, saying, you know, it was before it was cliche. It was like the terrorists win if we don't go on with the show.
Right.
And here's why, because Hef is this great proponent of the First Amendment and free speech. He's the reason the terrorists hate us, you know, and we got to do this. This will be great. Instead of an after party, we'll give that money to Twin Towers Fund.
Yeah.
Figured it all out right away with the help of Jean-Pierre Trebeau, the executive director of the Friars. We really had a real, we felt compelled to make this happen.
So what was it, like about 17 days after, something like that?
Something like that.
It's like the last weekend of...
Yeah, it was like the last weekend of September or something like that.
And it's going swimmingly until Gilbert Gottfried.
No, well, you know, it wasn't swimmingly necessarily. It was
It was solid.
It was solid, yeah. You know.
I mean, it was like nobody crossed any lines.
See. Jimmy Kimmel was the MC.
Right.
He set the tone, you know. Yeah. He got everybody laughing. Yeah. Which was really tough. You know, let's face it. These things aren't done with a warm-up comedian. And, you know, it's like you have to come out and set the mood, which in a post-9/11 environment is no one's done that yet. You know, the late-night shows aren't even back yet.
Right.
So Jimmy is essentially the man show guy coming out and getting it going, which no easy task is like moving an iceberg. And everyone's laughing in his opening. He brings out Rob Schneider. He's doing fine. He got a few jokes here and there. And then about six jokes into his act, he starts sliding.
Oh, no.
It's not really working anymore. And now here I am, the producer, in my ridiculous talks with a Southern Kentucky Fried comedian, as Jimmy called me.
Yeah.
Bow tie that Buddy Hackett gave me for added inspiration. And I run up, and Schneider's starting to get a little flop sweat, and I put my arm around him right at the podium, and I said, Rob, hasn't there been enough bombing in this city?
Oh, no.
Which was essentially the first 9/11 joke of the evening. And it was like, boom, big, big release of tension. You could just feel the audience sort of loosen up. By now, they've had their first drink, you know. And it felt like the combination, the 1-2-3 of Jimmy, Rob, and me kind of set the night off. Everybody went up and did fine. You had Cedric the Entertainer. You had Sarah Silverman. You had, Drew Carey and a few other people. All did great. And then there's the
I'll make jokes about Hugh getting erections and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, my God. It was really, really fun.
I'd convinced he died about 5 years ago, and they just move around like Bernie.
Hef will never let go. He's like the Fidel Castro of boobies.
Yeah.
They'll have to pry that breast out of his cold, dead fingers.
So tell the Gottfried part.
So, you know, Gilbert Gottfried goes on, and this guy doesn't have a filter like normal people.
Yeah.
You know, Gilbert is...
He's insane.
He's different.
Yeah.
And he goes up to the podium, and help me along here. I remember, like, he did...
I thought he said, sorry, I'm late, and that was, like, his first... That was
he
like
did a couple
opener.
Jokes that were fine, and then out of nowhere, he goes, sorry, I'm late. My flight is non-direct. It has a stop at the Empire State Building. So the last tall building in New York.
Right. You know,
he's making a joke about crashing his plane into.
And it just causes a riot.
The roasters are laughing because we don't know what else to do. It's Gilbert.
Yeah.
You know, it's like your little brother causing a problem at Thanksgiving. You know, you just go with it. But the audience is a little bit like, whoa. So they're like half and half laughing. And then someone yells, too soon. And that's what set Gilbert off. Now Gilbert stops. He's holding onto the podium, and he just stops talking, but he doesn't stop moving. Now he's like, I don't know what he's like. He thinks it's a time machine, and he can rewind 30 seconds, or he's going through some sort of odd transformation where, like a werewolf or something, he's turning into someone else.
Yeah.
And he's empowered by the fact that he's, like, pissed people off.
That this energy, he's feeding this weird energy, he's feeding from it.
He really does. And by the way, I chronicle this in detail.
In the Aristocrat?
Book. Oh. No, in my book. Because I went through all my letters and files and found out exactly what was said and what all the jokes were. And, you know, I don't have the brain to remember every part
this is
of
a
it.
Chapter?
Yeah.
Cool.
The Roast Must Go On, it's called.
Oh, we're going to get to it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm just saying. And he goes into this joke that I'd never heard, which apparently is an old joke called The Aristocrats.
Right.
This is years before the documentary
came
out. And it's a joke that's the filthiest joke ever.
Yeah.
It's about it's essentially about a family who does a variety show act, and
the most offensive act possible.
Yeah, the father walks into an eight talent agent. He says, "I got a great act. Well, what do you guys do?" And he goes into how a story about bestiality and
incest
and having sex in every conceivable way you can imagine, including
bodily
animals
functions.
And donkeys.
Yeah.
And it's dirtier. And every time you think it's the dirtiest thing you've ever had, he goes to another level. It's like deeper, deeper, deeper into hell.
Yeah.
Until at the end, it's unbelievably disgusting, and there's body fluids all over the floor and blood and guts and spit and vomit and everything you could imagine could happen in an awful, 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 awful show.
Right.
And finally the talent agent goes, "What do you guys, sounds interesting, what do you guys call yourselves?" And Gilbert like flourishes his arms and he says, "The Aristocrats." The punchline's not funny, but it's like everything that built up to that for 10 minutes. People are literally, there's a shot of Rob Schneider laying on the floor. He could no longer sit upright, right? You could see the tears crawling out of Jimmy Kimmel's eyes.
Like, yeah.
He knows that this is like some sort of like euphoric breakthrough of comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gilbert goes off like some sort of triumphant hero.
Now, why can't the uncut, you know, they have these roasts, they're heavily edited. I've seen the uncut footage a bunch of times, most recently.
Oh, wait, and then Ice-T took us all out to a strip club because we didn't have an after party.
Oh, that's how it ended?
Yeah.
Oh, it's kind of cliche, though.
No, hey, I'm all for it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. The
sometimes they're cliches for a reason.
The unedited roasts are frequently a lot funnier than the edited roasts, which bothers me about the Comedy Central, because they'll always cut out like one or two. I don't know. Like you, like I saw the unedited Joan Rivers thing, your friend that you sent.
Uh-huh.
There's a flow. You're getting a flow of 7 minutes. You're doing 7 minutes, boom. You're hitting all your marks. And you know what? It's a set.
Yeah.
But when Comedy Central edits it into like almost like a best of, I don't quite like it.
It becomes a highlights type of a thing. And, you know, my thing is like, when somebody does bad, they fight hard to get that taken out.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. But my thing with the roast is I like when they have a narrative.
Yeah.
When somebody does bad, like we were talking about, you know, Doug Williams and Moose Johnson, like when that stuff is in there, like when you're present in the live taping, it's like a movie. It has ups and downs.
Yeah.
And
it's like a Robert Altman movie. It's a 3.5-hour movie.
Well, sometimes someone goes long, sometimes goes short, sometimes you make reference to somebody who bombed. You know,
well,
another one of my best jokes ever was at that Heff roast, Tommy Davidson. I'll give you an example of one of my best moments that I'll never see television.
Right.
And it wasn't because it was dirty, it was because Tommy Davidson begged to have his set extracted from the broadcast. He didn't do well. He came out and he sang he sang Sammy Davis Jr., Candy Man, but you know, he did another word instead of candy to you, Hefner.
Like, yeah,
right.
Okay.
That kind of sounds same syllables as candy.
Yes,
and it's like you're the bam bam man, you know, and it's like it didn't go over great. And he's doing a Sammy Davis Jr. impression, and whatever, it's a little silly.
Yeah,
and you know, of course, I'm next, so I just go up to the mic, and my opening joke was, "Wow, Tommy Davidson, holy mackerel! If Sammy Davis Jr. were alive to see that, he'd poke his other eye out." Which, of course,
I kind of knew you were going there, but I still enjoyed it.
So it was a little, it was, you know, these things. Yes, they do get heavily edited. Sometimes it helps my performance, sometimes it hurts. I'm not
you were
lie.
When we were working together, because we wrote for Kimmel for the AMAs a couple years.
Right.
You were kind of down on the roast a little bit. You felt like you had taken it as far as you could go. You wanted to try other things. Now it seems like you've re-embraced them.
I did get a bit of a pep talk about that.
Who was the pep talk from?
Dave Chappelle, interestingly enough.
Wow.
Who gives advice, you listen, because this guy's walked away from more money than most of us will ever make in our lives. So
that means you should listen to him?
Yeah. Because he's not generated by money necessarily. He's the love of the game.
Right. Okay.
This is a guy who's been doing comedy since he's 14 years old.
Yeah.
Doesn't need them. Isn't about the money for him. It's always been about the creative aspects. And we've been friends for 20 years. And I listen to him when he talks. And it was like a late night chit chat. We were in Las Vegas doing something. And, you know, I was kind of saying that, you know, like, oh, I don't know, man. I just made the documentary about my trip to Iraq, and I was kind of enjoying branching out a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, don't forget, like, being the roast master's fun and all that, but there were times where the old guard gave me crap about putting him on TV. There were other times where, you know, you don't want to get pigeonholed, and then, you know, producing them was a headache at that point.
You were the bridge between the old guard and the new guard.
Which sometimes is fun and sometimes can be very painful.
You right.
know, when Milton Berle's calling you up going, why does it have to be on TV? It's supposed to be private. You know, and you go, well, because we want to make it big. You know, we want young people to know what this is. You can't get the whole world into the Friars Club, so you put it on TV so people start to understand the traditions of comedy.
And by the way, the roasts were televised in the 60s and 70s. It's not like they couldn't. I mean, there were some.
They did the Dean Martin
roast and some other stuff. So it's not
so
like
you need to. Right.
Yeah.
Well, the Friars roast we're talking about now.
Right. Different
you
level
know.
Of roast.
So I took the Friars roast to Comedy Central, and it was a painful transition, but made millions of dollars for a club that I love very much. You know, I always did it as a Friar. I never did it as a producer for the, you know.
How many people belong to, hold on, I'm interrupting you for a second.
Yeah.
How many people belong to the Friars Club?
A couple thousand people in New York.
You pay membership dues?
Uh-huh.
And like you're in town, do you say, I'm going to go to my Friars Club and I'm going to eat dinner in the Friars Club lounge? Like, what do you get out of it?
You go for lunch. You could go for a steam. They have a gym that's great.
They have a spa?
They have a, I don't know if I call it a spa. It's a medicine ball and stuff like that. It's a nice gym. Really nice gym. The food's great. They have all sorts of fun events. There's always a golf tournament or a comedy show or a book signing party.
All guys?
No. It's been mixed since the mid-80s.
Interesting.
Joan Rivers was the first woman ever to have lunch there.
Oh, so it was like an old school country club where like they only allowed the white males, basically.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eventually,
and they branched out.
I think Gloria Allred had something to do with breaking that down.
Hmm. All right. Continue your story.
What was it about?
It was about Dave Chappelle.
So Chappelle says, every comedian needs a lane. You know him. He lights up his cigarette. He gets real thoughtful. And he's like, every comedian needs a lane, he called it. Not a hook. A
I like
lane.
That. I like it.
And he said, it's really hard to find one that can take you all the way to the top. He's like, roasting is something that can grow and grow and grow. He said, so follow your lane. He said, you haven't been doing it long enough to run away from it. Embrace it. You know, capitalize on it. He didn't talk about it in money terms. He talked about it in creative terms.
Yeah.
Try it every way you can. And it made sense to me. It's like, oh, you got to be known for something. You got to sell in before you sell out.
So when I said all those things to you in 2005, it didn't resonate the same
way? Not the same way.
Yeah. I guess because Dave Chappelle's funnier and more successful than I am.
Well, maybe it was a matter of timing. Like, I was ready to hear it. And I was starting to understand.
I think my tact was more like, what are you doing? It's a great niche. What do you want to give this up for?
Yeah.
You're known as the best at this. This is a lucrative niche.
Yeah.
Now you've embraced it a little bit.
I started to like it again. I think part of it had to do with the resurgence. You know, when Jimmy hosted that Pam Anderson roast, he wanted his friends around him.
Yeah.
So I felt like that was a big boost to it too. Like,
These
roasts are a lot more fun. Great roasts are the extensions of great friendships. When you have your homies around, you feel empowered by that. You feel confident by that, you know, and you say more outlandish things. You know, if I do a roast and I don't know anybody, chances are I'm out the back door, you know, afterwards. But when you have your friends around you, you're really willing to hit hard.
It seems like you are from the last generation of comics, basically.
Hmm.
Like, are there under 30 comics? Like, do they have the same kind of kinship that the guys from your generation have? You know what I mean?
It's interesting.
You know all the guys, you know, whether it's Sarah or Patton Oswalt, you know, you've known all these guys forever.
Hmm.
And you've been at the same comedy stores and all that stuff. Now it's like, I'm not sure who's the next group. It almost seems like it's more digital and it's more like the Sandberg, like the Lonely Island guys. Like it's gone in a different direction. I'm not sure how many people are doing stand up anymore. Like, what's the impetus if you're 22 to be like, I want to be a stand up. This sounds great. You know what I mean?
I don't know if I see it that way, Bill. I see it as.
How do you see it?
I see it as. I once asked Buddy Hackett, I said, who was the funniest guy of your generation?
Yeah.
maybe this will help you understand it from my perspective. I said, who's the funniest guy of your time? And he said, he thought about it for a second. It wasn't like it was something he got asked a lot. And he said, well, everybody has a moment. If you're funny, everybody has a time where they're considered the funniest person. Either an appearance or a movie or something that they do, everybody goes, that guy.
Yeah.
And if you're funny and you stick around long enough, you'll eventually have that moment.
Hmm.
So you talk about, you know, different younger comedians. They don't know where they're going necessarily, but they're just doing their thing.
Yeah.
And there'll be a guy who's the next Richard Pryor. He might not come around for 20 years, but there'll be somebody who kind of does that.
So you think that could still happen?
I do.
Because I just think there's so many different ways now to get your comedy out. Back in like the 70s or whatever, it's like if you were funny, what were you going to do? You did stand-up. It's not like you could say, I'm going to make weird videos on YouTube and I'll get my creative outlet out that way. Or I'll have a blog. Or I'll start
Except
a Twitter
all those
account.
People are going to eventually get seduced by live audiences. You know, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, you know, thus, even if you talk about the digital thing, you know, talk about, you know, Dane Cook, somebody who made it big on the internet,
yeah.
it all fed his live concert performing because at the end of the day, for the audience, that's where it becomes a revival, an experience, a moment where you're like in the same room and nothing can really top that.
So that's something that you have to feed all the time.
I feel like I do, yeah.
What's the longest break that you take from doing stand-up usually?
Well, I'll always go around.
Have you gone like taking a year off?
No, I've never taken more than a few weeks.
More than a few weeks?
Yeah.
So it's almost like golf. You have to keep hitting golf balls.
It's like hitting the gym. You know, you have to do it to stay good at it.
You fall out of practice.
There was a couple years where this was sort of around the same time I was talking about like the Chappelle thing was like I wasn't going on the road at all.
Yeah.
I was staying around doing writing jobs and stuff like that around L.A. and, you know, producing different things, but not going on the road as a comic. And I would just go by the Laugh Factory and just putz around, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you smoke a doob, you go on stage, and you know, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
And I was killing. I'd go on after the best comics in town and still do well completely unprepared for 20 minutes. And that's when about the time I got a similar lecture from Rock. I said, Rock, let me go open for you in Jersey. You know, and we were in the dressing room afterwards, and he was like, Ross, why don't you go on the road? What are you doing? How many people can kill like that? Not that many. Just work it out for a year. See what happens.
Rock Hudson?
Chris Rock.
No, I was kidding.
And, you know, I don't even think he realized what he was saying or that I was really absorbing it fully. But, you know, his out of the corner of his mouth, you know, quick one-minute pep talk, he was about to go on. I'm just coming off. It's one of those, you know, we're just backstage for a second.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like I went to him for advice, but it was just like something he tossed off. But what he tosses off, I grab wholeheartedly and examined, and I go, if he even thinks that for a second, I really should try to, you know, this is the greatest comic working today, in my opinion. So
I agree.
I took that, and I said, wow, you know, like, I wonder what would happen if I committed for a year, went on the road, and just saw how that feels. And I did that.
What'd you think of Comedian, the Jerry Seinfeld doc?
I liked it. I don't think I loved it.
I felt the same way. I liked it.
It was painful. Because it was like looking in the mirror at 5 in the morning at yourself after you've been drinking. It's just, it was too close to home. You know, I love Jerry Seinfeld's comedy, but I don't necessarily want to see the deconstruction of it.
Yeah.
Because as a fan, it's like you don't want to know how the tricks are. And I don't want other people to know how the tricks are done.
Right. That makes sense.
I respect it as a well-put-together movie.
So you think Rock is still number one right now, 2009, July, August. We're in August.
I don't think you can really top what that guy does on stage.
Who else is in the discussion?
He's like a panther, you know, stalking the stage, and everything he says is relevant.
My only problem with him and with any comedian who gets too big is that when you reach a certain financial level and a certain fame level, I think it's tough. And I'm 100% convinced this is what did Eddie Murphy in.
Huh.
You become too detached from the real world and everyday life because everywhere you go, you're Chris Rock.
Right.
you go buy freaking Gatorade at the store, five people are staring at you. You're not soaking in like, oh, that's funny when the guy behind the counter does that. You're more worried about this guy staring at me. Is that guy going to come up to me? I think that can be a bad thing.
I see it more with musicians than comedians, because comedians are sort of wired where they're always going to feel awkward and outsiders, you know. You'll still see Chris Rock walking through a mall, you know, taking it all in. He might have a hat and sunglasses on now, but
yeah.
He's still sort of that guy where you always feel like the skinny kid in sixth grade, you know,
right.
Looking at all the popular kids.
So who else
but
is
I
in
see,
this
like,
discussion?
Sting. I remember Sting, like, becoming worldwide,
yeah.
And suddenly his songs were about something else.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that happened to you, too.
Me?
No, you, too.
You know...
You, too, all of a sudden was singing about, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and all these weird... They're from Ireland. What do they know about Martin Luther King Jr.? You know, it's...
My friend Eddie Gorodetsky, he has this thing about Springsteen where he says, you know, I'm a Jersey boy, so it hurt when I heard it, but it resonated and that there might be some truth into it and that Bruce used to write songs about people he knew and now he writes songs about people he read about.
Oh.
And, you know... I don't think it's good. I think comedians need to stay in tune with, you know, what makes them funny to begin with. It's
right.
Really tricky. They usually branch out into movies, but if you're somebody like Chris Rock, George Carlin, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, who stay on the road, I think these guys are careful to sort of, you know...
Dabble in real life.
Yeah.
You
don't hear
else?
Jerry Seinfeld doing jokes about the limo ride or the... You know, you hear
yeah.
him doing jokes about everyday things, and that's
right.
what makes it relevant.
Here's the thing about charter planes. Yeah, I guess that wouldn't fly.
Yeah, and that's why they could still draw, because they're relatable.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, other people, you know, I don't know.
So, Chris Rock, Sarah still has her fastball.
Absolutely.
Patton?
I just saw Patton at a K-Rock benefit not too long ago, and he was at Adam Carolla's house for a benefit and, you know, unbelievable comedian. The things that he talks about will never go away. He's always going to talk about popular culture, food, music, being a nerd.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I feel like his career should have been bigger. Maybe it'll happen. He's got this
bigger.
Movie
he's got a
out.
Big movie coming out.
I know.
He's Ratatouille for crying out loud.
But I'm saying he's one of the best comedians of this decade.
Yeah, I think
I don't know if the average person would throw him in to the top.
I think with Patton, I mean, as a longtime fan, I think it's a marathon for him, and he understands that.
Yeah,
you know, he's not the young cute kid who's going to get a deal.
Right.
He's got a life.
That really did hurt a whole generation of comics. I feel like.
What's that?
When they were handing out those development deals, and you know, you were good on stage for 6 months, and you got a CBS pilot.
It killed me.
It did?
It really messed me up.
What happened?
I made money, you know, when I was just starting out. Did Letterman.
Yeah.
Popped into a couple of healthy, lucrative deals to develop sitcoms, but didn't know how to act, was barely a good comedian, didn't understand writing.
You hadn't even honed your act yet.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I mean, I was headlining, but I wasn't like a killer.
Yeah.
You know, I had a good, you know, set, but it wasn't like I was at the level of somebody who was doing a big sitcom like Ray Romano or Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
You know, it's like no one, there's never been anyone that young who's had their own sitcom. There's
no.
Nobody in their 20s who gets a sitcom.
It's not a good idea.
There's nothing to talk about.
Even somebody like Seinfeld, you know, growing up watching the Lettermans, I knew Seinfeld for 8 years before he got that NBC show. And when he got the NBC show, I was in college and excited and telling my friends, we have to watch the show. I felt like he was my friend because he'd been on Letterman 50 times, you know, and he had so much time to hone what he was. But if you watch those early Letterman tapes, he's a little skittish. He's laughing at his own stuff. Like he wasn't even nearly what he became. If somebody had given him a deal in 1984, obviously Seinfeld wouldn't have been Seinfeld.
I think the real comedians, you talk about Patton Oswalt, Sarah Silverman. People who are lifers, who are long-haul comedians, they're not ready for a sitcom until they've been doing it 20 years. And that's all about – or a movie deals, you know, like the people we're talking about. It takes that long to really have a voice because you don't have to just be funny. Think about Ray Romano, Bernie Mac, Drew Carey, Brett Butler, Roseanne. All the people who had big sitcoms were in it 15 years before they – had those successful shows. They did failed shows. They did bad shows.
Right.
But they didn't have those kind of careers until they were doing it much, much longer. You know, for most women, you think that's too old to make it. But for a comedian, that's not – that's when you make it.
Yeah, everybody forgets, like, Jamie Foxx. Not only did stand-up, but he had that show that – they did, like, 200 episodes of that show.
Yeah.
Before he became a movie star.
Yeah, he had a Jamie Foxx
for a while.
And in Living Color before that.
Yeah, true.
You know, the guy doesn't – you're not going to win. He's in his 40s till he really is substantial and respected, and it takes that long.
So you think a comedian's prime – it's actually kind of like a writer's prime, I feel like, because I feel like a writer is like – I'm going to say like 38 to 46.
Like a Bernie Mac, like you know, may he rest in peace.
Yes.
He didn't become popular until he was well into his 40s. Yeah. He was just like – not only because he could he carry the show then – but he could promote it. That's the other key. You can't just, you know, I remember seeing a lot of friends when they were starting out, like, oh, I got an audition for Saturday Night Live, and they throw themselves into it if they get a shot like that on a show, or they get booked on a sitcom, and they lose weight, and they take acting lessons, and they do everything to prepare. But if you can't give the show 100%, you can only give it 80% because you have to use the other 20% to sell the show. You got to go on Jay Leno and Conan and kill. And that's a full-time job, too.
Right.
So you really have to be a fully realized comedian before you get those shots.
Well, I'm going to throw this at you. Maybe stand-up comedy comes back because now they're not handing out those network deals like that anymore.
You got to do it the hard way.
CBS only did 4 new pilots this year.
You got to
go out on the road and make it happen.
My manager always compares it to running for president.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, you have to build your following the hard way. Morning radio. I was in Denver all weekend. I did 6 interviews so that I could sell out. You can't just show up and, you know, I'm not honing my act so that I can showcase it in L.A. I'm honing my act so I could come back to Denver in 8 months for more money.
Right.
You're doing it for the right reasons. You're trying to really kill as opposed to just showcase.
So what are you going to do? So this book comes out. What's the name of your book again?
I Only Roast the Ones I Love.
That's a good one.
Busting Balls Without Burning Bridges.
Excellent. September 15th.
Yep.
Are you going to do what kind of tour?
I got all kinds of great press lined up. Very, very excited about that.
Going to do stand-up as part of the tour?
Yeah, I'm going to do some dates in some big cities where I feel like I can make an impact. I'll go to Chicago, New York, Seattle, a couple other places.
Do you have like a city that is like you've kind of adopted as your home away from home that you just kill every time you go there?
I don't know why, but I really find myself loving the gig in Chicago.
Really? Chicago's like one of those, it's got the history of comedy. It's a little more comedically maybe forward than some other cities.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, man, but I just feel like a certain swagger on stage there, and
yeah.
I'm selling out there, and I'll do some stuff there, and obviously I'll get all the, you know, lots of great friends and who have shows who will book me and help me promote it.
You have a few of those people.
Yeah. It gets tricky because there's, you know, some shows won't follow
some
other shows.
Shows, yeah.
And that's fine because a good thing about a book is not like a movie opening. You know, I can promote the book forever, essentially, for
right.
a year. You know that.
Well, you have 6 blurbs on the back, and I'm not one of them. And I, quite frankly, that hurts.
Yeah, well, I try
Here's
to keep
it
to really
on.
Good friends.
Chris Rock, Chelsea Handler.
She sells
your
a lot
friend?
Of books. Yeah, well, we're from Jersey. You know, it's a Jersey thing.
Kimmel. Bob Saget, he's your friend.
Yeah.
John Mayer, you're not friends with.
Yes, I am.
You're friends with John Mayer?
Of course.
And Sarah Silverman and Rachel Ray. Yeah, I guess so. I'm fine with that. John Mayer, you're friends with.
Mm-hmm.
Since when?
A couple years.
Yeah?
He hangs around the Comedy Cellar, you know, so.
He had a show on VH1. They gave him like a half-hour show that he did. It was kind of like a John Mayer on tour, kind of doing it out of his trailer type thing.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was really good. It was like 4 years ago. I've said this before. I feel like he has more talent than what the talent that we've seen. Like I wouldn't be surprised if what he's doing 10 years from now is different than what he's doing now. Does that make sense?
I think that does. I think that his potential is limitless. It's like one of those guys where he's so good looking, it's hard for certain people to see past that. Then he's such a good guitar player, people see only that.
Right.
And he's such a good songwriter that people get stuck on that. And then if you read like he wrote this amazing article for the Huffington Post about Don Rickles and insult comedy that was like, you know, something a Yale professor would write about comedy. It's just like,
interesting guy.
At that point, one of the most fun things we ever did together, he invited me to his 30th birthday party, which was a double party. His dad turned 80 on the same day.
Wow.
And it was at the Rainbow Room, Rockefeller Center.
Yeah.
Very fancy party. Beautiful, elegant. And it was cool. You know, his dad gets to see him sort of have this life.
Yeah.
And then Conan O'Brien showed up. You know, he has a studio downstairs at the time and came up, roasted John Mayer, which was hilarious. He's like, all the great blues guitarists come out of Connecticut, right? It's all jokes like that. And then, unbeknownst to anybody, mind-blowing, Tony Bennett walks in.
Oh.
And they hand him a microphone. There's an orchestra there in tuxedos. It's the Rainbow Room.
Yeah.
And Tony Bennett takes the microphone from the maitre d'. He puts it down on a stool, tells the band to take a break, and he sings Fly Me to the Moon a cappella.
Wow.
But no microphone and no band. And it was just like, it was like I don't even know.
Sounds like a moment.
It was like an angel singing this song. Like you heard it with your ears, with no amplification because he knew the room so well. And He's an older guy, so you hear all the life and all the experience behind the lyrics. It was really cool, and I thank John for letting me hear that.
I think guys my age, a little bit younger, there's that John Mayer backlash, and it comes down to two things, which men are instinctively trained not to like two types of people. There's more, but two in specific. Guitarists. Guitarists who can go sensitive and they make weird faces. Guys are out on those guys immediately. And then, if somebody is just bagging a disproportionate amount of good looking women, we're also out on that. So he's got two strikes against him constantly, but somehow survives. I don't feel like people are 100% against John Mayer, whereas if it was really anybody else, they would be, which I think is a tribute to him.
I think he sells it with his sense of humor. Like he's self-deprecating all the time, and that's how he gets away with it.
Yeah. Although I still don't understand how he dated Jessica Simpson. I have the same problem with Tony Romo.
Have you gotten a good look at her body?
Is she that overwhelming in person?
She's pretty hot, man.
Because after seeing that show, I can't imagine like going out to dinner with her or something. If you had an IQ over 100.
Yeah, I don't think...
You don't think it matters?
I don't think it's her conversational... I mean, at a certain point,
you think that's her acumen?
We're talking about a guy in his 20s dating the hottest woman in the world.
Dating a blonde with natural
I don't know, man.
Attributes.
Not for me to say, but...
So the book, 256 pages, you wrote it yourself?
Yeah.
No help?
A lot of ghostwriter? A lot of great pictures.
You didn't have Cousin Sal ghostwriting it or anything?
Cousin Sal wrote the chapter about Cousin Sal. No. I did let him look at it, though. I didn't want to... I didn't give it to him. He stole it off Jimmy's desk. But I think it's important for everybody to be in on the joke. That's one of the messages of my episode with Cousin Sal.
And you're getting along with him again?
Very much so.
You guys had falling out.
Well, we had a huge
A lot of people don't know this story, so I hate to dredge it back up. But
no, it's no problem.
Dancing with the Stars, Cousin Sal calls you day of, says... Don't worry about it. You're safe. You assume that he had inside info because he works for an ABC show.
Right.
You got voted out. Freeze frame of your face. You're in disbelief. Sal was like never been happier about anything. You were like legitimately hurt because you felt like he betrayed your friendship.
Right.
And how did you resolve that?
Well, you know, I was also injured.
You got hit in the eye.
I got hit in the eye on Dancing with the Stars. You know, I had a scratched cornea dancing with an eye patch against doctor's orders.
Yeah.
I get the lowest score, like, since Master P refused to wear proper dance shoes. You know, Heather Mills' leg flew off. She got a higher score than I did. Christopher Reeve did a wheelie, fell out of his chair. He got a higher score than I did. And I'm thinking the whole time that this is my... You know, I'm going to make it. Despite the injury, I'm going to get the audience sympathy.
It's like a Rocky Balboa type thing.
And this is my second dance comeback. We had two dances. So I'm putting on my tuxedo, tying my ascot, You know, it's Dancing with the Stars. It's totally ridiculous. But once you're in it, you've been training 5 weeks every day, all day, to learn these two routines. So I do the first routine. It goes bad because I'm hurt. Now it's a new day. My eye's starting to feel a little bit better.
Right.
You know, the drugs that they gave me are starting to wear off. I'm getting my peripheral vision back. Doctor says you can dance tonight.
What you call peripheral?
Peripheral. I don't know the word. I don't have much of a vocabulary.
I like that. I hope you didn't try to spell that in your book.
They have people who take care of the spelling mistakes for me.
Yeah.
What is it?
I think it's peripheral.
Okay.
Yeah. That's all right.
And that's why you have a giant mansion, and I'm in Denver at the Comedy Works. And, you know, Buddy Hackett used to say, turn your phone off an hour before the show. You got to concentrate. You owe it to your audience, blah, blah, blah. I leave my phone on because I have, like, my sister and my aunt and uncle and my cousins are all looking for me at the
trailer. They're all excited for you.
They're all there in town, you know, rooting me on, Dancing with the Stars. 23 million people. Largest premiere ever the night before. Here's day two of a three-day premiere. And we go to air in 10 minutes. I get a text from Sal. You're safe. Don't tell anybody. Wahoo! I hit the ceiling, you know, of my trailer. I dance over to my partner Edita's trailer. Knock on her door. Coach, we're safe. We're going to dance tonight. This is huge. This is the greatest comeback ever. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is it. We're going to be famous. This is crazy. I text Sal back. Are you sure? Yes. Three letters. Capital. Y-E-S.
Well, hold on. I got to intervene for a second. You've dealt with Cousin Sal now for like 10, 11, 12 years at this point.
Yeah.
Practical joker extraordinaire.
Gets
lives to tell lies. So he just roped you in. You just somehow believe Cousin Sal, the one person you should never believe ever about anything.
Well, you know,
you have to blame yourself a little bit. I don't want to use the he was asking for it defense. But
he really wrote me in. And, he, you know, he wrote a bit for me and my partner the week before to help us promote it on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Why not?
He was really in my corner.
Why not email Kimmel to follow up and make sure?
I had no time. I was being mic'd when I got the
text. Gotcha. All right. Like, so you trusted your 12 years of friendship with him that he wouldn't mess around with something this important.
Right.
Okay.
I figured we were friends and he was putting that, he knew how hard I'd worked.
Right.
And he knew I was hurt.
But if you had taken that 3 seconds to think, nothing would make him happier than making you think that.
I said, are you sure?
Yeah.
And he said yes.
All right.
That was his chance to get out of it.
All right.
He knew
good
he
point.
Had. He knew he would believe me. Otherwise, it's not funny. I mean, he knew I would buy it.
Right.
He roped me in really, you know. He was very much in my corner for weeks leading up to it, checking in with me and helped me promote it.
So you think this was a calculated multi-week ruse by him?
Of course.
Okay.
And I go out on the stage, and there's 13 couples. There's usually 12. They added 13th couple this year.
Yeah.
My season. And for two straight hours, we're all up on a stage, and Tom Bergeron announces who's safe, and then they get to do their second dance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm doing the quick step. I have a tuxedo on. I'm doing Frank Sinatra. You know, I get a kick out of you. I'm incorporating my karate moves. I have a bouquet of flowers. I kick over.
You got your bad eye. You're playing hurt.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really cool thing for me. You know, to me, it's like people say, why are you even doing this? Back in the day, comedians could sing and dance. They were showmen. This was my way of paying homage.
It's a variety show era.
To the great roast masters who came before me.
Yep.
So it means a lot to me to do well. And not embarrass myself.
Yeah.
So Tom Bergeron announces every couple. You know, Warren Sapp, safe, dances. Brooke Burke, St. Cloris Lee, everybody gets to dance. Gets down to two couples, me and Kim Kardashian. She's very popular. And she's very nervous. I'm literally stretching my hamstrings, ready to dance, because I know I'm safe. I'm telling my partner's nervous. She doesn't believe Sal.
Yeah.
She'd met Sal. She doesn't believe it. I believe it.
I didn't know the story, but when it was down to you and Kardashian, I wasn't feeling good for your chances. Because you think of all the horny boys that are voting potentially.
Well, I figured I was safe.
Yeah.
I'm waving to my family.
Yeah.
You know, here we go. I'm telling Edita, don't worry, we're dancing next.
Yeah.
Commercial break. We'll find out who gets eliminated and who gets to dance right after this.
Yeah.
Rob, the producer, walks over. Kim, Jeff, come over here. So he says, okay, one of you is going to get to dance, and one of you is going to go over there to that mark and make a final speech to the country.
Right.
And I realize he's only looking at me.
Uh-uh.
And like a WTF goes into my head, like, what the heck is going on here? Why are you looking at me? And he gets all like, gets all weird.
Oh, boy.
He leaves. Tom Bergeron comes back from commercial, and they eliminate me. And it looked like I just watched a shark take off my foot. You know? My face.
It was great.
I'm speechless.
Now, comedy.
So now I'm eliminated, and I don't have a closing speech.
Yeah.
So it's just like I have my pants down. I'm completely... Samantha Harris puts a mic in my face. She's the host. She says, how are you feeling right now? And I'm like, this is a nightmare.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it was. And all I could think in my head is Sal, 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 Sal. It's like a little car alarm going off in my head.
You're just making the Seinfeld Newman face over and over again.
Newman! Newman! I take my family out to Cantor's Deli. I'm so sick to my head.
Yeah.
I go home. I shower off the makeup. I check my text messages. It's one from Sal saying, sorry, dude, I messed up. Totally sarcastic. 4 hours later, I have to be back at Dancing with the Stars at 5 in the morning to do a live hit with Good Morning America. So now I'm back at the scene of the crime, like in the middle of the night.
And plus, nobody hates getting up earlier as much as you. Yeah.
I go do Jimmy Kimmel that night, because whoever gets voted off goes right to the Jimmy Kimmel show to be the special guest, you know, where they burn your dance shoes.
And Sal was a little too pleased with himself.
I'm still wearing the ridiculous outfit. Sal walks in my dressing room. Dude, tough break. And I never came this close to raising my hands at him. I was so mad.
I'm glad you didn't, because you would have probably lost.
I don't know about that.
Sal's got that weird wrestling background, though.
I'm a black belt in Taekwondo.
That would have been a good fight, then.
And let's not go there.
Who's favored in that fight?
The times that he's come after me physically, and this is also my book. There's a picture of him putting me a headlock on the floor of the Man Show writer's room.
Yeah.
You know, this is a guy who threw me in the pool at Adam Carolla's wedding. He wrote all my punchlines in spray paint on my Porsche once. Like, he's gotten me bad a few times.
Yes.
Have I ever gotten him back? No. It's beneath me.
You'll never get him back?
I feel like the chapter I write about him in my book is sort of my revenge.
He gets a whole chapter?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. There's a Cousin Sal chapter.
There's a whole chapter.
That's exciting.
So we go weeks. We go weeks without talking.
You were mad. I got to say, there's two people I never want to see a somber version of. It's you and Gus Johnson, the basketball announcer.
Interesting.
There's somber Gus Johnson or somber Jeff Ross. I feel like we've all failed.
It took weeks for us to figure this out.
You were really – and in fact, why don't you share the name of the person who healed both of you?
Tom Cruise.
True story. You were there the 1 week that Tom Cruise decided to go by Kimmel's house for football.
Tom Cruise had just appeared on Jimmy Kimmel Live. They did a funny bit together, and Tom, I guess, somehow got himself invited over for football.
I think he invited himself over.
Yeah, that was what I don't know. So, you know, Sal has since been on the radio saying I'd do it 100 times over. It was the best gag I ever had. He's
very
rubbing
happy.
It in. Yeah. You know, his attempts at making up were lame, in my opinion, and
he did send you a gift. I thought that was nice. He sent you peanuts.
He sent me cigars.
Cigars, yeah.
And
that was nice.
Which I took as a nice gesture, but there was a note from cigars.com that said, note included. So there was no note. So I said, well, it's just, he's sending me a gift with no note. So I just emailed him. I said,
you didn't feel like that was heartfelt?
Well, it said there should be a note, so I thought maybe he should know that it wasn't included.
Mm.
You know, if he spent time writing something, he should know I didn't get it. So I wrote him, got the cigars. It says note included. And he wrote back, now you need a note?
Oh, boy.
So it's like, oh, he's being a jerk even when he's trying not to be a jerk.
Yeah.
And I was just like, so I broke one of the cigars in half, took a picture of it, emailed it to him, and said, this is our friendship. I said, cigars.com, next time try apologies.com. Triumph sends me better cigars. So I'm keeping a sense of humor about it, but I'm upset.
But you're still smoldering.
And, you know, it's like they're saying, how could a guy who says such mean things, you know, not take a joke? And I said, I got the joke. I laughed about it when it happened. It's all the acting after.
Yeah.
All the, like, you know, when a friend's upset, you say, I'm sorry. Don't be upset. It was, we could all have a laugh about it. But he's enjoying rubbing it in.
It was the victory tour.
Right. And
so Tom Cruise somehow brought you together. Victory tour. So Tom Cruise hears both sides of the story.
I hadn't been at Jimmy's in a long time. I went up once with John Stamos for moral support, and it just became where...
That's a great name drop. That might have been your top name drop.
Well, because I was like, you know, I missed everybody, you know?
Yeah.
You got Jimmy's cooking. You got.
I was
the
there
guys.
The day you and Stamos came over, and yeah, it was a little tense.
It was a little tense, and they're dropping stuff that to me was not real evidence. They were saying, "How could I say this mean thing about Tommy Lee at the Pam Anderson roast?" And I said, "I didn't actually say that. I said that at a poker game to try it out, and didn't actually say it at the roast." Then they're like bringing up other stuff I did on another show, and I was like, "That's not really what happened." Like I saw. I felt like I was getting ganged up with weak evidence.
Right.
I said, I'm not really, I'm not feeling this. And, you know, let's just agree to disagree and I'm out of here.
And you left early.
Another month goes by. I'm on the road. And everywhere I go, I'm in New York. Somebody from the audience yells, F Sal! You know.
Mm.
And I'm in Chicago. Somebody stops me on the street and goes, that cousin Sal is such an a-hole, blah, 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 blah. I'm at Disneyland with my nephews. And some ladies like, you know, that's Sal, blah, 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 blah. People are really like suddenly interested in this like feud between me and Sal. And I see that me being quiet about it is backfiring on him. Like people are starting to understand that maybe what he did wasn't so nice.
So you were almost, you
then
became
I hear
a
from
sympathetic
a couple of
figure.
Relatives, then I hear from a couple of relatives and close confidants of Sal.
And there's I see only so many of those.
His story is unraveling. He's not getting the support.
Right.
I see Sal somewhere at the San Gennaro feast. I notice he's like, he's losing weight. I see his hair is thinning. His sister told me he was very stressed out.
Yeah.
And he wasn't dealing with this well. And I start to go, huh, this is really affecting him too. And I start to feel a little bad about that, you know, but it's like, I tried. I went up there, you know, I don't see this. I don't see how we're going to fix this.
He lost weight because he stopped eating pizza and cheese, I think. But for the purpose of the story, I'll go with it.
Mm. He seemed like he was.
I will agree that he was affected as a friend of both of you. I will say I don't think he values his friends very much so. And I don't think he liked that he had unresolved stuff with one of his friends. It did bug him.
And same goes for me. It was hurtful. It was pained. You know,
you guys go a long way back. I mean, you're going way back.
We have a lot of
back.
Affection for each other.
Yes.
And our fights always brought us closer together.
Yeah.
I would say.
You guys were, you're the Tom and Jerry of real life. And I don't know who was Tom and who was Jerry, but.
Fine. So, I can't take it anymore. I just miss everybody else. I'm like, I'll ignore that, you know, lying little troll.
Yeah.
I'll go up there anyway. See what Jimmy's cooking, see what the guys are up to. And everybody was happy to see me. You know, just by showing up, I was showing that I was the bigger man.
Yeah.
Everybody clapped when I came in because I hadn't been there in a long time.
Yeah.
For this is Sunday football at Jimmy's house. And, you know, everything's fine. Sal's avoiding me. He's fidgety. You know, the Cowboys are winning, so I know it's not that. I know it's me.
Yeah.
He's like hiding behind Frank. He's like a little kid.
Yeah.
Cowering, you know.
Wow.
And he's avoiding me. He won't even make eye contact with me.
I find that hard to believe, but go ahead.
I'm telling you.
I bet he was fidgety because he probably had action on every single late game.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Suddenly, completely no one could ever imagine this would happen. SUV pulls up, and I look to the right, and I see Tom Cruise is in the kitchen with his mom. They're holding cupcakes.
Unexpected.
And this is very strange.
Yes.
You've seen a lot of heavy hitters walk into Jimmy's kitchen, but this is crazy.
He's a top five heavy hitter, I think.
And before I know what's going on, Jimmy's Uncle Frank grabs me by the arm across the kitchen. He goes, Tom Cruise, do you know my favorite comedian, Jeff Ross? And Tom Cruise gives me his hand. He goes, I believe we spoke briefly at the Matt Lauer Friars Roast in New York. And
ooh.
I'm like, wow. Not only does this guy remember me, but he's like...
I've heard that about Cruise, that he can remember anybody he's ever even brushed by.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's pretty neat. Because let's face it, I spoke to him for 5 seconds at that roast.
Yeah.
You know, he went up and killed roasting Matt Lauer.
He did?
Yeah, he was amazing. He was really amazing. One of the best first-time roasters I've ever seen.
Huh.
Just, he came up completely surprised everybody in the room, unannounced, unintroduced, walked up to the podium while people were still eating. Show hadn't started yet. And did a 10-minute evisceration of Matt Lauer that was drop-dead hilarious.
Is that on YouTube or anything?
No.
Huh.
No.
That's too bad.
Yeah. There's some clips and quotes online.
Yeah.
So Tom Cruise is in the kitchen, though. And we have a, you know, it's very cool. I go, yeah, you were really great that night, blah, blah, blah. Don't think much of it. They're sitting down eating. And I go in the other room to watch football with some of the guys. Suddenly, Sal appears next to me, whispers in my ear, why don't we let Top Gun figure out who's right and who's wrong?
I like how he used the Top Gun.
And I think about it for a second. You know, it's like the first thing Sal's really said to me in a long time.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, now here's a guy, Tom Cruise, who has on the dais experience.
Yeah.
Here's a guy who understands the difference between making fun of somebody to their face and making fun of somebody behind their back the way Sal did to me.
And he's also a stage 5 thetan.
What's that mean?
I don't know. Isn't that a Scientology term? Did I use that correctly?
I don't know.
Whatever.
And on top of that, he has played so many righteous lawyers.
Good point. Didn't think of that.
He has to understand right from wrong.
Right.
So I say, okay. Sal walks over to Sarah Silverman and explains the situation. Mm-hmm. Sarah's there. Sarah lets everybody have a little food. Settle in. Tom Cruise relaxes a little bit. Sarah steps up on a coffee table in Jimmy Kimmel's living room and says, okay, it's time for the big sit-down between Sal and Jeff. And Tom Cruise is obviously momentarily confused.
Yeah.
Sarah says, and Tom, you'll be the ultimate decider on who's right and who's wrong and how to fix their friendship. And Tom Cruise is like, got a cupcake in his mouth and he's eating Jimmy's chicken parmesan. And he's like, huh? What? Hmm? It was like... And Sarah went on to explain the entire story that I've just told you.
Yes.
In great detail, and she kept it funny and light.
A tough one for her, because she was dating Cousin Sal's best friend and a longtime friend with you. She was kind of in the middle, I would say.
I think that made her, in essence, objective.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And Tom agreed. Why, I don't know, but I think he thought it would be fun, and I also thought that he could be useful. He'd be doing what the Jews call a mitzvah, a good deed.
Yep.
And we lay it out. Sal lays out his side, Jimmy helps him, and I lay out my side. I don't know if Sarah helped me. I guess Sarah helped me.
Yep.
And Tom Cruise asked a lot of thoughtful questions, and his mom said, at certain points, said, I think the two of you are acting like little boys. She really laid into us.
Wow. Mrs. Maypo there.
She was very cute and very sweet. And it took a good 45 minutes, I would say. And
it ended with a Shawshank hug?
What's that mean?
Like you would read an Andy on the beach at the end of Shawshank?
No, it wasn't like that.
Huh.
It was not huggy-kissy. It was contentious. It got emotional. And my voice is cracking at certain points. You know, we're still in it. It's an open wound. And Sal's telling me I'm being a b-. And I said, so what if I'm being a b-? Friends, don't let friends be upset. You say I'm sorry and it's over.
Yeah.
That's all I care. You know, it's not like, there's no, it's not like we, this is not fixable.
Yeah.
You're just being stubborn.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't like the way you treated me. It was on national television. You put a gag for your late night show above our friendship.
And it was a huge professional moment for you when you were blindsided.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of debate about all this stuff. And, you know, I talk about how much work I, Tom Cruise was fascinated by how much work I'd put into learning this second dance that I didn't get to do.
Well, because he was the guy who spent 4 months learning how to juggle bottles and cocktail. I mean, <he's>, nobody threw himself into roles like Tom Cruise.
So he's sympathetic.
Yeah.
And in the end, Sarah says, all right, Tom, what's your verdict? And Tom Cruise sat there for what felt like 10 minutes in complete silence, thinking.
Just like with the Tom Cruise, A Few Good Men, trying to decide how to handle Colonel Jessup face?
It had everything but the background music. It was really cool.
I can't believe I missed this.
And you see Sal, like, clenching up, and you see me nervous, twitching, and,
yeah.
You know, Jimmy's just trying to, like, Jimmy is enjoying every moment of this ridiculous powwow.
He thrives on uncomfortableness. He
eating
loves
it. Up.
As long eating as he's not involved, then if he's involved, he hates it.
And finally, Tom Cruise looks at Sal and says, you've hurt your friend's feelings. I think you should apologize.
Wow. That's how it ended.
No. So Sal sits up. He looks at me and he goes, as I've said a million times, I didn't mean to. And he just starts qualifying it. And
yeah.
And Tom Cruise cuts him off.
Wow.
No, Sal. No qualifiers. Just apologize. Sal tried again. He looked at me in the eyes and said, I'm sorry, pal. And that's when Tom Cruise, he was holding a football because it's Sunday football. He grabs me and Sal on either side and he has a shake over the football. And there'll be a picture of it in my book.
You know, if I didn't know that story was true, I wouldn't have believed it.
It's crazy. That's
it's
why,
a crazy
that's why
story.
We had to take a picture. So a couple weeks later, it's Christmas Eve. Jimmy invites me over for Christmas Eve dinner. And I brought Sal some salt and pepper shakers I'd found in New York. There are two guys hugging.
Huh.
And as legend has it, we finally smoked those cigars out over the Christmas sky.
I'm glad because America could not handle the two of you guys not getting along. I
apparently,
know.
It was a huge problem. It was finally resolved.
We got to wrap this up.
That was fun.
Your book is called I Only Roast the Ones I Love. It comes out on September 15th. Now.
You can get it earlier.
Yeah, if you guys out there, if you like Jeff Ross, which I hope you do, pre-order the book. Comes out in like 6 weeks. Doesn't matter if you pre-order it. It won't affect your New York Times bestseller list because it all goes for that first week.
Mm-hmm.
We'll help Jeff. Help his book company get an idea for who might buy this thing.
That's nice.
And it'll be funny. You'll laugh. You'll get the Cousin Sal Tom Cruise story.
I also
lay out. Anything else in there?
There's a lot of. I talk about saving Courtney Love's life at the Pam Anderson roast.
Oh, that's a good story. I know that
story. We roasted her into rehab.
Yeah.
I give away my secrets for writing roast jokes.
I was at that roast, and she was a 10 out of 10 on the train wreck scale.
Yeah.
She was they edited almost all of it out, but she was just. Not meant to even be in public anymore.
The joke that people use when they try to tell me that I'm the meanest person in comedy is when I said to Courtney Love, how is it possible that Courtney Love looks worse than Kurt Cobain? And you
could
see in her face that the brutal honesty was registering.
Ugh.
And the next day she went and got help. And people constantly credit me with saving her life by roasting her into rehab. So roasting saves lives is one of the chapters.
I like that.
I also give away my tips for toasting friends and family at parties and family functions. I give away some of my secrets for writing roast jokes, which I think comedy fans will get a big kick out of.
I like how you reinvented one of those jokes with I don't want to give it away.
Which one?
I'm going to bleep it, but the initials are CB. You'll know it when you hear it if they use it. Do they, they'll keep that, right?
No, I think they're going to use that one. Okay, I think they're going to honestly keep my set pretty intact because...
The initials of the punchline involve a person with the name CB.
I don't mind putting a joke out there. People will still laugh because you'll have the reactions of the people on the
All desk. Right. Well, what are your most famous jokes? Actually, in my opinion, the most famous joke of this decade was the roast. What roast was it with B. Arthur?
I was roasting her friend Jerry Stiller.
Right. Joe Mead, you have to bleep this, but we're fine with the bleeps.
Okay.
B. Arthur's on the dais. One of my all-time favorite funny people. I mean, this is a woman who can make anything hilarious.
She could sell either shock or laughter or all kinds of
and
things.
And I figured like I had to get her worked into my roast somehow.
Yeah.
And I'm following Sandra Bernhard, who normally can do really well with these roasts, but in this particular occasion, she decided to sing... to Jerry Stiller. I think she sang Magic Man or something ridiculous.
And just as uncomfortable as her King of Comedy scene.
She's essentially giving Jerry Stiller a lap dance while she's singing this sultry song. And he's wincing and it's very uncomfortable and she gets off and they introduce me and I say, Sandra Bernhard, holy shit, I wouldn't fuck you with B. Arthur's The joke's fine. It was her reaction.
Right.
That made it a home run.
The B. Arthur reaction.
She leered at me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, it stopped me in my tracks.
Yeah.
Enough where I felt like, oh my God, I've really made an impact here. And, you know, people say it's, you know, one of the great roast moments.
I would agree.
And then for years, I'm hearing about it everywhere I go.
Yes.
So then I'm thinking, wow, B. Arthur, she must be hearing about it too.
Yeah.
So I track her down. It's like 2 years later, 3 years later. I go to her one-man show, whatever.
one-woman show.
And I wait on a big long of line of fans to get a picture with her. And it gets to me, and I go, Miss Arthur, I don't know if you remember me, but we met at Jerry Stiller's roast. And halfway through that, she just looks at me and she goes, you nailed me, you prick.
Nice. So she has a sense of humor about it.
It was really cool. And she invited me back to her dressing room and
So you reinvented that joke during this joke by saying...
I said to Kathy Griffin, who was emceeing the Joan Rivers roast that's on this weekend, I said, Kathy Griffin, holy mackerel, I wouldn't you with Chastity Bono's nude... You know, regular readers of the tabloids will know that Chastity Bono is now Chaz Bono.
That murdered me.
That was a good one.
I don't know. I don't know if you should have gone with Chaz or Chastity. It's a tough call.
I just feel like...
I like the...
It was tricky. I did think about that.
Because Chastity, then you got the new, so that ties in. Chaz is new. That wouldn't have worked as well. I think you made the right call.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff Ross.
So September, much fun. So much fun.
August 9th. The Joan Rivers roast on Comedy Central, 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock. I saw the performance. It's great. And then the new book coming out on September 15th. Good luck with everything.
Thanks for getting the word out, Simmons. You're a good friend.
Thank you for coming on the BS Report. We will talk to you next week. That was Jeff Ross, not on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline in studio, but still. Until then.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news, which frankly cannot go unstated. This summer, Subway is teaming up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for just $5 to some of the hottest Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See the nearest Subway for details.